Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Kazakhstan has erupted in mass protests and government violence. Is there a potential that the protests can lead to democratizing an authoritarian country? And then, the COVID-19 pandemic is raging with yet another variant. What is the effect of the Omicron variant, and what's behind the lack of vaccinations for it? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On January 2nd, protests erupted throughout the Central Asian nation of Kazakhstan. The proximate cause was a drastic increase in fuel prices, but soon the protests spread throughout the nation, including the former capital city of Almaty. The rising fuel prices led to protests of popular discontent against the three-decade rule of former President Nazarbayev. His hand-picked successor, Tokayev, has sacked the country's government and declared a nationwide two-week state of emergency in response to these protests. He has also invited troops from a Russian-headed military alliance of former Soviet states into Kazakhstan to restore order. Scores of protesters have been killed and hundreds have been injured in clashes with state security forces. Police have also been reportedly killed in these clashes. We will discuss the cause of these protests, what it means for democratization and stability in the Central Asian Republic, as well as the Russian-led military response. Our guests are Erica Murat, Associate Professor in the Regional and Analytic Studies Department at the College of International Security Affairs, National Defense University in Washington, D.C. She's the author of The Politics of Police Reform, Society Against the State, and Post-Soviet Countries. Steve Swerdlow, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He was Senior Central Asia Researcher at Human Rights Watch and has conducted extensive field research internationally with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. And Robert English, Associate Professor of International Relations and Co-Director of Central European Studies Program at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Russia and the Idea of the West. Erica Murat, first, what has been developing in Kazakhstan and how is this country a vital player in Central Asia?
Kazakhstan is one of the largest countries in the world. I think the territory is the eighth largest in the world, almost the size of India and Western Europe. It is an oil and gas and minerals rich country that has been economically developing over the past 30 years since it gained independence from the Soviet Union. But it's also been managed by authoritarian leader Nazarbayev for almost three decades, who did not allow for any opposition voices to arise. And he essentially created a network of oligarchic elites who benefited from the wealth offered by the territory of Kazakhstan while leaving the majority of the population in economic uncertainty, especially in areas where oil and gas are extracted in Western Kazakhstan. Seeing this inequality and an unfair distribution of economic resources, the population has been growing increasingly dissatisfied with the leadership, and a hike in gas prices this winter has been the last straw that first triggered small protests in Western Kazakhstan and then resonated with the rest of the country, basically mobilizing population in all urban areas across the country.
Now, Steve Swerdlow, there have been reports about protests and in particular recent days about security forces firing on the protests. Seems to be a rather violent response. What have been the effects of the protests and the government response?
Well, thanks for having me. This is a human rights catastrophe, unprecedented. Of course, yes, as Erica said, the discontent, the human rights abuses have been simmering for 30 years. And certainly there were a lot of signs that the crackdowns the successive crackdowns by the authorities were getting worse and worse. We had the 2011 Janazen violence also in Western Kazakhstan when striking oil workers were gunned down. We had 2016 land protests that ended violently with the arrest of political activists. Increasingly, we've seen the introduction of Russian-style foreign agents legislation to curtail the work of NGOs and civic freedoms really going by the wayside. And then in 2019, when we had this succession of power, Nazarbayev formally stepping down from the presidency and taking up his position on the National Security Council for life, that also was accompanied by, for that time, also unprecedented protests, very dynamic protests. But what we see now is really a collapse in some ways, certainly of law and order, but in other ways, a really complicated process. As Erica said, protests that began over gas prices in the West, and then really peaceful protests by civil society, again, dynamic in Almaty, the biggest city in the Southeast. And then by January 4th, January 5th, chaos unfolding, other elements being introduced, which the government used as a pretext to label this, in short, a terrorist, talk about the need for a counter-terrorist operation, and then invite the Russia-led collective security treaty organization with a so-called peacekeeping mission. So all of this has cascaded, but what we shouldn't forget at the beginning of our conversation is we have over 3,000 at least people arrested. Dozens killed in terms of civilian protesters, although that's just the beginning, given the information blackout and the internet outages that have been so frequent over the last few days, we don't really know. And then we have other official accounts. Again, I think it may have changed, but around 25, 26 law enforcement personnel also killed, but great amounts of violence unseen in the last 30 years in Kazakhstan. So all of this adds up to a real catastrophe from a human rights perspective. And again, I just don't want to lose focus of that humanitarian catastrophe. We saw authorities opening up using stun grenades and cold water cannons on crowds of people in the dead of winter. People over the past few days not able to get food because the banks were closed, the ATM machines didn't work, so people really going hungry in their homes. So on many, many levels, this is worrying. And what we've seen in President Tokayev's most recent statements have been allusions to the protesters as bandits that need to be liquidated, and references to things that we're used to hearing Vladimir Putin say when he's talking about operations in Chechnya. Bandits that need to be liquidated. And so all this is very, very worrying and very fluid. And obviously there's an internal power struggle going on, or that was going on over the past few days in Kazakhstan, but I don't want to lose focus of the humanitarian and the human rights toll.
And Erica, I've been reading that because there really wasn't a sustained opposition movement in Kazakhstan, or at least a well-organized one, that there's an assumption that these protests really have been fairly organic, that these were small groups or individuals taking, to the streets to protest. Is that a pretty accurate description from your reading?
Yes, absolutely. These protests were spontaneous collective action by various types of activists and civic organizing. So in Western Kazakhstan, we see more organized protests by labor unions, by miners who work in oil fields in Western Kazakhstan, and they have a vast experience, almost a decade of experience of organizing for their labor rights. So they use this experience this time as well. Whereas in urban areas, it's a wide range of different participants. It's the just regular ordinary residents who maybe never participated in collective action before. It is youth movements like Oyan Kazakhstan that have been demanding that Kazakhstan gradually transforms into a more open political system. They've been doing this for the last 2.5 years, almost 3 years. And then, yes, overall, it is a leaderless protest. There is no one single person or political force or even a group to talk to or the authorities. Because they lasted for a few days, some demands began to crystallize in the general public discourse of what the protesters want, until, of course, the government tried to violently disperse them with tear gas and, at this point, with armed forces.
And Steve Swerdlow, I do want to ask, the trigger for this were rising fuel costs, correct? But that seemed to be a way that people took to the streets and then decided, you know, there's a much larger issue about governance, about, you know, democratization, et cetera. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, and it's a sad irony that the oil-producing, oil-rich region of the country, Western Kazakhstan, which has been at the heart of the enormous profits that have led to lavish and opulent lifestyles on the part of Nazarbayev and his clan and close associates, is also one of the poorest areas of the country where costs continue to be high. And the initial spark was this rise in what's called liquefied petroleum gas prices. Government quickly backtracked and lowered the price, but it was too late. Those demands had, and again, as you said, broadened first to more socioeconomic and then political, outright explicit calls for the government to resign. But most importantly, we were hearing the chants of Shalket, which means old man leave, directed at Nursultan Nazarbayev. And then we saw dramatic imagery of the statue of Nazarbayev being pulled down in a city in Kazakhstan, which was really, again, a Rubicon that hadn't been passed yet for a place with such a strong cult of personality. Now, Kazakhstan doesn't often get viewed in that way when looked next to Turkmenistan or Tajikistan, where you have an atrocious, abysmal human rights record. Kazakhstan, it's more of when I was with Human Rights Watch, we talked about an atmosphere of quiet repression, where a series of laws that curtailed civic freedoms led to a stamping down, a repression of civil society. And that has increased over time. And I think that's one of the stories that hasn't been told enough is repression in Kazakhstan, political prisoners, dozens, endemic torture in prisons. And of course, all of those things connecting with the labor concerns, the labor unions.
Rob English, it seems like one of Russia's MOs is when a country on their border, certainly a former Soviet republic, has this kind of uprising, Russians are pretty ready to intervene. Is this a pretty typical Russian intervention in the neighboring country? What's motivating Russia's interest in sending forces in Kazakhstan?
That's not how it seems to me. I think in this case, Russia's a pretty reluctant intervener. And if you follow the sort of political elite, the foreign policy think tanks, Kremlin connected or independent in Russia, there's a pretty universal sense of fear of getting sucked in to something that could become a quagmire. There's a fear of being drawn into direct use of force. Thus far, the Russian contingent there, around 3,000, are being used in the background to guard buildings, public places, infrastructure, transportation points, but not to apply the violence. And if they were drawn into shooting, tear gas beating, that would very quickly turn the Kazakh people strongly anti-Russian, which they are not at present, not a majority at least, not strongly anti-Russian, and that it could go very wrong. But on the other hand, they cannot allow chaos to proliferate in this huge country right on their border, which could lead to multiple all bad scenarios that would impact Russia directly. So the way you asked the question when you said Russia's MO to me, and maybe I read something into it I shouldn't have, but that implied sort of a Russian plan or like to say the strategy or the book, Putin's book. Many people have tried to draw parallels with Ukraine. And there are some parallels, certainly. And I think we could look at the Maidan protests and the explosion of violence, of anger in Ukraine repeatedly because of corruption, because of low living standards, because of an oligarchic elite living high while people live in poverty. That's certainly a strong parallel. But what Russia has done, or at least has done so far in this case, is almost reluctant, not jumping in because they see an opportunity to somehow take control or actually grab territory. No, they see that would backfire badly. However, let me just add one more point, because if you've been following the news and comments out of the Kremlin elite, you've also seen a couple of rather, how to put it, unwise, provocative, arrogant comments, which quite openly said, well, if we're going to go in and help, we expect something in return. One of Putin's press spokesmen and someone else from the foreign ministry essentially said exactly that in a kind of crude quid pro quo way. And it was even suggested that one of the pro quos would be Kazakhstan officially recognizing Crimea as part of Russia, right? Which would have symbolic value, but it would matter to the Kremlin. And maybe being more compliant or more supportive, at least verbally, at least rhetorically, at the UN and so forth, to Russian interests. The main point is, I think that thus far, it could change. Events could force a change. But so far, Russia would love, I think, if its role didn't expand much more than this, and they were seen as helping the regime, so the regime recognizes its dependence, is more compliant without requiring a massive involvement of troops and direct application of force and interference that could very badly backfire.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the ongoing crisis, protests, and violence in Kazakhstan with Erica Murat of National Defense University, Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California, and Robert English of the University of Southern California. Steve Swerdlow, you had a response to that as well.
As Rob was speaking, I was looking at the list of conditions that this chief, as they call her, technologist or PR spokesman, but really state-sponsored spokesman, Margarita Simonyan, tweeted out. She's the head of Sputnik Russia Today, and her conditions were that Kazakhstan, in exchange for receiving this peacekeeping so-called mission that would save the regime, that they would, number one, recognize Crimea as Russian territory, number two, return the Cyrillic alphabet, number three, make Russian language officially the second state language in the country as it is in Kyrgyzstan. And another, but very important point, there were a few of them, was to expel so-called anti-Russian NGOs, meaning Western NGOs, human rights NGOs, independent NGOs. And that really, really worried me when I saw that. And, you know, no matter what happens with the CSTO peacekeeping force, and there's been a lot of discussion about the geopolitics about it. And certainly I agree with Rob that this could be a quagmire. This could lead to a lot of things. At this point, we don't know. But whatever happens, I think one thing is for sure is Russian influence becomes stronger. And from a civil society, human rights perspective, that sort of influence in Kazakhstan is only going to further, I think, fuel a crackdown on civil society. And of course, this is also happening just 10 days or so, 12 days after Putin took the final step to close down the most important human rights organization in post-Soviet space, which is called Memorial, which was doing work that affected all of that, the entire region. So all of this is not good from a democracy and human rights standpoint, no matter how long or how enduring this peacekeeping mission turns out to be.
Erica Murat, right now, it seems the narrative is that the violence has been pretty asymmetric. It's been state violence against, you know, against protesters, though I know there's been some reports, for instance, of police being killed. Does this have the potential of erupting into a civil war, or does it look like it's almost assuredly going to remain this asymmetric violence of the state committing violence against civilians, but the stability of the country is likely not going to be challenged?
So what we have now is CSTO contingents from its member states deployed in Kazakhstan. And although they may not be in central parts of Kazakh cities, it is still the government's show of force, basically international armed forces on the territory of Kazakhstan, dealing with the population of Kazakhstan, unarmed population of Kazakhstan that the regime calls as terrorists. It is inherently asymmetric. It is as asymmetric as it gets, unarmed civilians versus international military force, including from Russia. It's not going to be a civil war with the current state of affairs, but CSTO will not solve any of the grievances, and more dictatorship, more repression will not make those grievances go away. So mobilization will continue to organize, maybe underground, and the people now know that they can rise together. They will rise together. It's a pressure cooker at this point. There will be more collective action in the future. And the worst case scenario, it will turn into something like Belarus, where the regime continues to expand its arrests and torture. And the best case scenario is that the peaceful protest will finally convince the government to consider deeper political changes. Although, given the last few days, I'm not holding my breath for this more optimistic scenario.
And Rob English, what Erica just said kind of was on my mind about how similar is this to what's going on in Belarus. And it seems like, at least from the Russian perspective, I don't know if it's a question of the devil you know versus the devil you don't know, or if it's, you know, but Russia has certainly been accused in these instances of intervening in order to keep the leader, the old leader, who isn't terribly democratic and is well known and aligned with Russia, in power. Is that a scenario that would play out in Kazakhstan, where the Russians are pretty pleased with the government in Kazakhstan thus far and would be concerned about what might replace it?
I guess in part, I don't think they know yet. They want stability next door, and that could take various authoritarian forms. It doesn't have to mean the most brutal autocracy, as long as Russia doesn't perceive threats, either in the form of violence spilling over, pushes for regime change, or things like extremist drugs, contraband, religious extremism, whatever it is. They don't want any of that. And they were satisfied, by and large, with Nazarbayev's so-called multi-vector foreign policy, the balance between China, Russia, and the West. And of course, things like changing the official language, alphabet, and so forth are irritants. I think they matter more to Simonyan than they do to most in the Kremlin. And if you're watching any of the news coming out of, official statements coming out of Kazakhstan, you hear a lot of people speaking Russian. So I don't think most Russians in the country, any more than Russians in eastern Ukraine, were immediately threatened with having to learn to use the Kazakh language overnight. So Russia's interest, as I said, is the Kremlin's interest. This is not Russia's national interest. As Steve would remind us, as Erica would too, in the long run, Russia's national interest is in a transition to something more democratic, something more stable with popular support, that would also be more just and egalitarian instead of an oligarchic elite sucking parasitic off the people, because that's a formula for disaster, violence, and turmoil in the future. But of course, authoritarian leaders don't see it that way. Their horizons are only their own lifetimes and their clan, their people. So they're interested in stability next door and a regime that is basically supportive at a minimum, not aggressive or antagonistic internationally, right? So in the case of Ukraine, joining NATO is simply a red line that Russia doesn't want to see crossed. We'll go to great lengths to prevent that. That's not in the offing here in Kazakhstan. And Kazakhstan has not threatened Russia internationally, has been, as I said, a good balancer. So they don't know what the Tokayev regime will be. But I guess the first thing I should have said before that long digression into theory of authoritarian neighbors was they're not sure about this regime because it's young. And thus far, the level of corruption, the dominant elite, those things haven't changed greatly. There seems to be a bit of maybe a major power split between the old Nazarbayev group and Tokayev trying to put his people in and using this opportunity. But that's an internal Kazakh affair. That's fighting among oligarchs, among the, you know, authoritarian and exploitative elites. But that doesn't matter to Russia so long as the result is stability and no spillover. So Russia will support, intervene, and has. That's what they're doing, right? Intervening to try to keep that regime in power because the alternative is unknown and they're afraid chaotic. If you could assure Putin and the Russian elite that a slow transition to a more liberal, less repressive system would actually result in more stability and be better for Russia too, a trade partner and so forth. They might go along with that. But of course, they see Afghanistan, right? They see colored revolutions that result in more violence and new regimes that come to power that are no better than the other ones, only they're more hostile to Russia. And they imagine the worst, you know, the paranoid streak that they have. So it's the devil they know, and they're happy with authoritarian leaders. And if Tokayev ultimately can reestablish control, repress, and enforce a kind of calm that will last at least for the foreseeable future, that's maybe the best they think they can hope for.
And Erica Murat, these protests have created a bit of an opening in Kazakhstan, the possibility for political reform. Now, I know in the short term and medium term, human rights abuses and violence against protesters will likely be the ultimate result of these protests. But has it created the kind of opening that could potentially lead the country towards greater democratization, greater responsible governance?
I think in the short term, it's safe to say that there will be more repression and tightening of screws all around, suppressing any kind of public discussion. But what Kazakhstan is undergoing today, and I would make a case for Belarus as well, is what inevitably awaits any post-Soviet country where the institutions, the state institutions were created by the Soviet system, and they continue to replicate some of the Soviet practices by serving the incumbent at the top and not population. And we see such popular uprisings anywhere on the post-Soviet space, so Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, Armenia, Moldova. And what these countries have different from Kazakhstan or Belarus is that they were more open earlier. And it is a sign of a greater politicization of the population, more civic engagement, and the expectation, the more developed, articulated expectation of the population from their governments. So Kazakhstan is undergoing this transition at this point. And it might take a while for things to stabilize again and for some type of political system to emerge. Tokayev may be using international military to stall this process, but it's inevitable. And I would hope that Tokayev and Lukashenko and Putin understand that. But it is inevitable. It's just it's a question of when it will happen. And what emerges after that is we see in Ukraine and Georgia and Kyrgyzstan, those are not necessarily politically stable countries. And they seem chaotic and inherently unstable and unpredictable for people like Putin or Tokayev. What those countries also have in common is that they have more dynamic political discourse. They have greater freedoms, more NGOs, more civil society organizations in general, more independent media, and just generally a greater political engagement among the population.
And Steve Swerdlow, I want to ask you the same question. Is this potentially opening up a space in Kazakhstan where we can expect some improvement of the human rights, at least in the long term? Because I imagine in the short and medium term, you're pretty pessimistic about the human rights climate in the country.
Well, I think a lot certainly depends on the international response. I absolutely agree with Erica that the processes of civil society mobilization, the basic, essential, fundamental desire for freedom goes forward and is inevitable. And as many have pointed out, you know, the 2019 protests in Kazakhstan that happened a little over 2 years ago were some of the most vibrant, and certainly in Central Asia. You know, the writing was on the wall that something was bound to take place in Kazakhstan. So we have to pay attention to those things. So yes, I mean, of course, to be in the business of human rights, you have to be cautiously, pragmatically optimistic about what the future can bring. But I would say that if the international response that we see includes some more creative responses, such as using U.S. legislation, which is now, you know, there's a lot of activity around corruption, anti-kleptocracy. If we see some of the Kazakh oligarchs around Nazarbayev that have been involved in repression added to the list, having their visas denied, their assets frozen, and more of a focus on kleptocracy, on this robbing the people blind, and more consequences, policy consequences for shooting stun grenades and water cannons into these crowds, then that might mean something. I still think that there's leverage and there's an opportunity here for the European Union, for the US to do the right thing. They just have to be, in addition to the private diplomacy, I think they have to be public about their calls, that they are extremely concerned. So I'm hopeful that there will be something. As Erica says, over time, we will see this movement mature even more. What Tokayev's position will be, the coming days are going to show how this power struggle between Nazarbayev and Tokayev shakes out and what that means for the internal politics of the country. But the NGOs, the independent media, the labor union, the legal profession, the journalists, and the political prisoners still behind bars, they in Kazakhstan, they need our help. And they need the help of scholars and international institutions more than ever.
And actually, one quick follow-up to you, Rob. Steve was highlighting the role of the European Union, perhaps the United States, and having some degree of leverage over Kazakhstan. Obviously, Russia would seem to have, you know, the greatest amount of leverage, but are there other avenues of leverage over Kazakhstan, or is the international actor that's really going to play the largest role, maybe even the only truly significant role in this case, is Russia?
In the short term, certainly. I mean, in the coming weeks and months, with the intervention underway and the operation to try to restore order, repress the protests. But then in the weeks and months after, you know, there's a lot of investment, right? Maybe that's an avenue we should explicitly raise. I think Steve is talking about sanctions along the lines of Magnitsky or related to Navalny in Russia, where those who we can identify as engaged in repression or engaged in corruption supporting the regime that contributes directly to repression need to be put on these lists and need to suffer, who haven't so far. And one reason maybe they haven't is, unlike in some of these other countries, there's a huge Western and a huge American interest in the oil and gas business, right? We have a conflict here. And it's no secret to those who've been following this that Kazakhstan has been one of the countries, maybe second only, or maybe even tied with Azerbaijan in my amateur assessment, who have most successfully used money, not just the awarding of contracts, okay, for oil projects. I'm talking about money spent to seduce scholars and think tanks. I would almost go so far as to say some universities to participate in sham election oversight and assessments of progress. I mean, it's a real mark of shame. I won't name names, but some of us know exactly who they are, who have whitewashed the repression of the regime in Kazakhstan. So that is not as bad at this present moment as it was. What's happened now, we have to look back at ourselves, what corruption, the K Street kind of lobbying that's become very dirty beyond even legal lobbying for Kazakhstan, like Azerbaijan and their caviar diplomacy, and the oil and gas industry, right? So maybe there's more leverage there, but that means that we're going to have to pay some price too. There are powerful Western and American interests who are more like Putin, right? Who have the same interest in going back to the status quo. So we need to live up to our standards too, across the board, and then we'll be better able to criticize, to apply pressure and be consistent and unified with the EU, human rights and democratization forces in so doing. It'll work better if we are not hypocrites.
This is an ongoing crisis in Kazakhstan. As the events will continue to unfold, we will continue to follow it. But certainly, the short term, we have to be extremely concerned about human rights violations, the human rights of Kazakh protesters, and the use of force on the part of the Kazakh government against those protesters. And hopefully, this is the beginning of an opening where this remarkable country can begin to start moving towards democratization. Our guests today have been Erica Murat, Associate Professor of the Regional and Analytic Studies Department at the College of International Security Affairs, National Defense University in Washington, D.C. She's the author of The Politics of Police Reform, Society Against the State in Post-Soviet Countries. Steve Swerdlow, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He was Senior Central Asia Researcher at Human Rights Watch and has conducted extensive fieldwork internationally with a particular focus on Central Asia and the Caucasus. And Robert English, Associate Professor of International Relations and Co-Director of the Central European Studies Program at the University of Southern California. He is the author of Russia and the Idea of the West. Thank you all very much.
The COVID-19 pandemic is raging with yet another variant. What is the effect of the Omicron variant, and what's behind the lack of vaccinations for it? Stay with us. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Vaccine hesitancy has slowed the effective response to COVID-19 in the global north, while lack of vaccine distribution has slowed the response in the global south. What does the new Omicron variant portend? Doug Becker explores.
COVID-19 has a new variant. Omicron has drastically increased cases throughout the world and has governments contemplating new measures, including lockdowns and moving school back online. The lack of global vaccinations, owed partially to maldistribution to poorer nations and partially to vaccine hesitancy among certain populations, has seemingly given rise to this new variant. Today, we will discuss the impact of the Omicron variant, the campaign to increase global vaccination rates, and a general sense of pandemic fatigue. Our guests are Heather Whipfley, Associate Professor of Clinical Preventative Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Investigating Global Mental Health, Contributions from Political Science and Network Influences on Policy Implementation, Evidence from a Global Health Treaty, and Adva Gadot, Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Center for Global and Immigrant Health at UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. She's the co-author of Incidence of SARS-CoV-2 Infection Among Asymptomatic Frontline Health Workers in Los Angeles County, California, and Cross-Sectional Assessment of COVID-19 Vaccine Acceptance Among Healthcare Workers in Los Angeles. Thank you both for joining us. Heather Whipfley, I've heard a lot about the Omicron variant. What is the Omicron variant and how does it differ from what we've been dealing with for the last nearly 2 years?
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be back again. And I hate to say I told you so, but I don't think the arrival of a new variant should be a great surprise to any of our listeners. As those in public health, such as myself, have been predicting that new variants could and would arise as the result of a lack of vaccination worldwide. So this very much is the kind of arrival of what we've been predicting for now 2 years, which is, just slight changes to the existing virus that has allowed it to avoid some of the basic protections offered by the vaccines developed. And yet just emphasizing again, and throughout this entire conversations, that the vaccines that have been developed and that are being administered around the world are still very effective against this new variant and reduce mortality and morbidity from COVID. And so, yes, we have a new variant and it is shaking up things, as we're all very aware, but vaccines are still very effective. And the bottom line remains that we need to get as many people vaccinated, both in the United States and around the world, as quickly as possible to return to what will be a new normal life.
And Adva Gadot, I know you've done some research on vaccine hesitancy. We have this vaccine available. Why aren't people taking it?
Great question, Doug. I think that is a multi-pronged response to that. You know, when we first rolled out vaccine and were surveying healthcare workers in Los Angeles about would they take it, how do they feel about it, how confident are they in the vaccine, and what are their reasons motivating them either to accept vaccine or to refuse vaccine, we saw a lot of hesitancy stemming from this sort of guinea pig notion. I think a lot of people at the beginning of the pandemic were really concerned that this is a new technology, that it hadn't been vetted quite enough for their liking. And I think a lot of people don't fully understand the intensity of the FDA's screening process and trial process through which these vaccines are vetted. So there was a lot of skepticism and a lot of hesitancy around new technologies that people feel have not been tested fully enough. You know, now we're in a very different phase of the pandemic where many millions, hundreds of millions of people have received this vaccine and several doses of these vaccines now, and can see far more anecdotally in their own lives and through published reports that the vaccines are quite safe and effective in a way that they hadn't before. And now the hesitancy is stemming from a lot of other factors, political factors, personal belief factors, a lot of pushback against perceived mandating, real mandating, and an idea that people don't have agency over their own healthcare decisions. So we have to, I think, combat a lot of this hesitancy and refusal that's coming from a place of fear or a place of the unknown, continue educating people and also meet people where they are, help them feel that they're able to have agency in their own healthcare decision-making and that they can choose to take the vaccine because it's right for them. We need to convince people of that.
And Heather, is it fair to say that these new variants are derived from the lack of vaccination, that the more difficulty we have in vaccinating people, not only here in the US, but all over the world, is what's leading to these new variants?
Well, I think that's a complicated answer. And I think the clear kind of response is that as long as we have unvaccinated populations where the disease is spreading easily, and we have populations that are only partially protected, that we can expect to see the virus continue to mutate and we'll have new variants. And probably for many years now to come, we're going to continue to see new variants. And the only and best way to protect ourselves from the evolving virus is to be vaccinated. And so it's learning to live with this disease, as many people are now talking about accepting that COVID is now endemic worldwide and that we will have to be vaccinating and boosting ourselves for years to come. And that's the best way to protect ourselves from whatever the disease may throw at us. There is definitely still populations worldwide who need the vaccine, who don't have access to the vaccine. And the world needs to continue to focus on ensuring that we have equitable access. And there's still a lot of work to be done to ensure that that happens.
Advan, that's always been one of the great ironies for me, is that we have vaccines available in the US and actually throughout the global North, and people aren't taking it. And there's this pretty intense need for vaccines throughout the world, and in particular across the global South. I guess part of the answer is, why not just take all these vaccines that aren't being used in the global North and vaccinate the global South?
That's a great question, Doug. So actually there is an alliance called COVAX, which is working to do exactly that. It's being led by Gavi and the World Health Organization and several other global NGOs. And basically the premise of COVAX is exactly that, to have G20 countries purchasing doses of vaccine and helping donate them to middle and low income countries so that they can afford to vaccinate. I think their goal is 20% of each country's population. So the issue with a lot of how COVAX has been running is, first of all, that it's reliant on donations from high income countries in the global North. So the people in the global North have to decide and have the political will to give away some of what they perceive as their own country's vaccine supply. And in a lot of cases, that's highly unpopular in their own country. So they have to fight against perceived anger from constituents in that regard. I think another big issue with COVAX so far has been that a lot of the doses that have been given and have been donated have been very close to their expiration date, and they've been donated on a very ad hoc basis, so that countries in the global South have not had an opportunity to really plan for their receipt and for an efficient rollout of their distribution across their highest risk populations, first and foremost. So that's been very difficult as well. These last minute donations where countries decide, okay, no one wants it here anymore, we're gonna give them away. But by the way, they're expiring in 2 weeks. Good luck to you. And a lot of those vaccines, especially these newer mRNA vaccines, require really intensive cold chain maintenance. They have to be frozen at very, very low temperatures. And a lot of countries in the global South just simply don't have the infrastructure in place to maintain that cold chain and get them distributed widely. So a lot of those issues are stemming from the shelf life of the vaccines that are given, the timeline in which they're distributed and the forewarning that is being given to countries who are receiving these vaccines on when they might expect them, where and how.
And Heather, I know you study the World Health Organization. I think that's something we've actually talked about, that one of the weaknesses is the completely voluntary nature, you know, for funding and contributions. Is there any conversation about strengthening G20 commitments beyond what Ava just described as kind of a, you know, we'll give you what's left close to expiration and actually making this something that's mandated on the part of G20 countries?
Not potentially around G20, but the World Health Organization has had some emergency meetings. They just had a very unusual fall World Health Assembly to discuss the negotiation of a new treaty that would focus on stronger commitments from countries and requirements for them to track and respond to global pandemics. So there are some discussions about developing a more formalized and kind of applied international governance system to respond to future outbreaks. But I think that doesn't really challenge some of the main hurdles that have confronted the world when it comes to vaccine access during COVID. And most of those kind of referring back to our international trade regimes and patent protections. And the fact of the matter is that the major vaccines that are being distributed around the world right now are patented vaccines from large pharmaceuticals. And those large pharmaceuticals have been unwilling to release their formulations to generic producers and to ramp up manufacturing around the world. And unfortunately, a number of countries have supported those industrial interests. I'd like to note that because just this past week, my colleague and friend, Peter Hotez at Baylor University just announced that he has a new vaccine and a new vaccine manufacturing agreement with colleagues in India to develop his and release his vaccine that's Corbevax, and there's no patents, no strings attached, and they're calling it kind of the world's vaccine. And this is the type of leadership, scientific leadership, and industrial leadership that we really need in order to get ourselves out of this predicament and have enough vaccine available, because now we're not even talking about vaccinating the whole world once. We're talking about vaccinating the whole world twice, three times, annually, and that's so much vaccine that we need to be producing, that we need to have a wholly different approach to its development, manufacturing, and distribution. We can't just be relying on the goodwill of donations after they're done with it in you know, as you say, in the north or in high-income countries, which now are using more and more because what would have been donated is now being used for boosters. And so the supply that we had projected just isn't available, and we're far, far behind on even our initial commitments to vaccinate low-income countries.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the distribution of vaccines globally, as well as vaccine hesitancy in certain nations, with Heather Whipfley of the University of Southern California and Ava Gadeau of the University of California at Los Angeles. Ava Gadeau, then, that would seem to overcome some of the concerns if you could lift the patent, because my understanding, a good amount of the vaccines actually produced in the global south, isn't it? Not necessarily it's produced here in the United States and then shipped off. So is this really sort of at the core, possibly a trade issue, and the medical emergency could actually lead to hopefully some conversations that maybe lift the patent and let global south countries produce their own?
It's definitely in part a trade issue. It's in part capitalism issue and an issue about how we nationalize and potentially globalize our vaccine production and our healthcare distribution in general. And I just want to echo what Dr. Whipfley was saying, which is, you know, not only is Dr. Hotez's new Corbevax so exciting because it can be produced so much more quickly and around the globe in existing facilities, I want to point out, because it uses an existing technology that's actually used in the hepatitis B vaccine, which is produced all over the world. As you know, there are so many vaccine production facilities in the global south as well. They simply don't have the infrastructure to produce mRNA vaccines yet. This vaccine and this type of strategy to use vaccine technologies that exist and for which there are manufacturing facilities available already in the Global South helps reduce that time it takes to build up, to scale up, not only the facilities for production, but a lot of the know-how in distribution, in training personnel and how to distribute, but also to store and keep these vaccines running effectively. So that eliminates a lot of that. It helps for scaling up quickly. And because it can be locally produced in country and not sent from necessarily outside of the country, I also think it would go a long way towards helping assuage people's fears over vaccinating. And I think it really will help reduce refusals and hesitancy because these aren't, you know, reject vaccines or being perceived as reject vaccines from elsewhere. Oh, we're done with these. You can have them now. These are being produced fresh. They are made especially for this purpose, for this country's population. And they're produced in-house so that people can have faith that, you know, citizens of their own country have their best interests at heart and are producing these vaccines for them and for their community.
And Heather Wiffley, the world is definitely experiencing pandemic fatigue. And I will personally acknowledge I am definitely feeling pandemic fatigue. What's the likelihood that this fatigue might compel some different thinking about vaccinations? I mean, there seems to be a global acceptance that we're going to vaccinate our way out of this pandemic. So might that change some of the thinking, or am I just engaging in some wishful thinking?
Well, I'm right there with you, Doug, with the fatigue. And I think, you know, everyone is right there, including the public health community itself, who's unfortunately kind of bearing the brunt of communicating the ongoing challenges and needs to protect our communities. I think that, you know, the message is and continues to be and will remain that we need to vaccinate to protect as many people as possible. And at this point, that's probably, I hate to say that we're going to vaccinate ourselves out of this disease, but it is likely to be an endemic disease now in our population. And the best and way to protect yourself is to, you know, practice all the things that we've learned, which is vaccinate, mask, separate when needed. Before COVID broke out, I used to talk to my students about how, you know, we in global health really push for the use of bed nets to protect populations from malaria, and yet we don't wear masks in the wintertime to protect ourselves from influenza. Now in the post-COVID world, you know, we're going to wear masks. We're going to wear masks probably for years to come. And that's why I think I started off by saying to you, like, get back to our new normal. There's no going back to the world of 2019. I don't think it exists anymore and across the spectrum of culture. And so, you know, to think about where we're going in the future, it's going to be a slightly different relationship, I think, to viral spread more generally, and understanding that there's variants and there's other diseases that are emerging, and we have environmental degradation and climate change and all kinds of other challenges that are changing the way that we're going to interact. And so, you know, I think that the fatigue is real, and I think we have to accept that there's going to be new normals and there's going to be new risks, and we're all figuring out where that line is going to be. And the best thing that each of us can do individually is to vaccinate ourselves, follow public health recommendations to be as safe as possible. And the world is going to open up again.
And Audra Godeau, we have about 90 seconds left. Is the fatigue going to lead to higher rates of vaccination among the more hesitant populations?
Well, I sure hope so. I hope that the mounting number of vaccine doses given and the safety that has been shown throughout, you know, millions and millions of doses being given out will help convince some people of the safety and efficacy of this vaccine. That said, I could also see very much a fatigue of, you know, now there's all these breakthrough cases, especially with Omicron, which is so transmissible. Does the vaccine really do anything? And I know a lot of people feel this way and are really kind of at their wit's end and concerned, you know, that even the best protection measure we had isn't helping. And really, it really is. I know all of my healthcare worker friends are so very much seeing on the front lines in the hospitals every day that almost everyone who's coming in with severe illness is unvaccinated. And so really, as we do move from this acute pandemic phase into the endemic phase, vaccination is going to be key to preventing huge surges in hospitalizations and severe disease and turning this into a much milder annual thing. And beyond that, we have control measures that are much lower tech that we can always employ, especially when we're having big waves right now, like masking, not gathering indoors unmasked, and not eating in restaurants. Please, people, don't eat in restaurants in the midst of a huge, huge surge. Get takeout, support your businesses, but do it at home and wait till this wave subsides, and then you can go back to your favorite restaurant. So there are low tech options as well, and I think we can all get there together.
I definitely look forward to a new normal where I'm fully prepared to get vaccinated twice a year if necessary, just like flu shots. Mostly the idea of being able to go back and teach in person, maybe have a meal indoors and get together with friends. But I will echo that. We've been discussing the Omicron variant and the current state of the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guests have been Heather Whipfley, Associate Professor of Clinical Preventative Medicine and International Relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Investigating Global Mental Health, Contributions from Political Science and Network Influences on Policy Implementation, Evidence from a Global Health Treaty. And Adva Gadot, Adjunct Assistant Professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Center for Global and Immigrant Health at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health. She's the co-author of Incidence of SARS-CoV-2 Infection Among Asymptomatic Frontline Health Workers in Los Angeles County, California, and Cross-Sectional Assessment of COVID-19 Vaccine Acceptance Among Healthcare Workers in Los Angeles. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers. Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.